Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Deeper Daily Podcast for the 31st day of July. I'm your host, Paul White. Today will be the essay edition. Before we give you the essay edition, I want to remind you two things. First of all, there will be a full drop tomorrow on our podcast, on our video, on our website, paulwhiteministries.com, PWM at YouTube, or wherever you're listening to the Deeper Daily Podcast. We have a full-length sermon. It's approximately a 45-minute message. It was taken from our recent trip to Chapin, South Carolina, and it's titled Reversing Eve. This builds on some of the things we talked about this week on the podcast, where Adam and Eve eat from the tree in the garden. But we don't start in the garden. Instead, we start in 1 Timothy 2, where Timothy is told by the Apostle Paul that Adam was not deceived, but Eve was. To that, we tack on 2 Corinthians 11, where Paul says that Christ is the husband. And then we take Christ the husband and Eve the deceived into the garden to see why Adam might be eating from a fruit even though he's not deceived. And if Christ is the husband and we are Eve, what does that say about that moment? You don't want to miss Reversing Eve. The other announcement is that if you like a print version of the Deeper Daily Podcast, you will find it at paulwhiteministries.com, and by print version, I don't mean every podcast. I mean this particular podcast, the essay for July. And now, this is for the July 2021 essay edition. This month, we arrive at our fourth and final essay on the lessons and insights gleaned from the book of Jonah. I'm not quitting the journey at four because there's nothing more to say, but because I need to find a place to stop, lest I write Jonah essays forever. There really seems to be that much material. I stop at four because four is the number of chapters that little Old Testament book contains, so it feels right. And I stop because I have so much more to say. And I've settled myself on the fact that it needs to be said in a broader sense. In other words, the little book of Jonah will be the subject of my next book. The essays end so that the greater volume of writing can begin. We've written an overview essay of Jonah, just a short look at the powerful implications of the book and its anti-hero. We intimated that the story may be about more than Jonah, postulating that it could be about the mariners, or the whale, or the shrub, or all of the above. We've also written about the process of fleeing, stacking Jonah up with a better equivalent from the New Testament, Peter. Both heard the voice of God at Joppa. Both were instructed to take the gospel outside of their preferred circle, and both struggled with that call. The fleeing is common to us all, as is the whale and the beach. We get to the end of that journey and pray we're more Peter than Jonah. And last month, we wrote about the others and our treatment of them. This was an agonizing wrestling over how we see those who do not look like us, or act like us, or worship like us. The journey took us to Jesus and his Good Samaritan story, and forced us all to answer the question, who is my neighbor? If you're like me, you're not always pleased with the answer. Aside from the three essays, we've also preached a trio of sermons dealing with Jonah over the course of the last few months. One of these was in a church, and two were videos that we recorded for the online audience, but in every case, They were the result of the deep dive research and hours of wrangling with this most tempestuous of prophets. One sermon compared the boat ride of Jonah with that of Jesus. One sleeps on his responsibility and there's hell to pay. One rests during a storm and there's a great reward to follow. Identifying our storm is easy, but knowing why it exists is another matter altogether. That sermon, titled, What Do You Mean, Sleeper?, encouraged me to examine my own rest and determine if it's the sleep of a man who knows who he is and where he is going, or the slumber of a man who doesn't want to know who he is or where he is going. To a fine congregation in West Virginia that graciously puts up with my annual ramblings about Scripture, we delivered a sermon, Be Careful What You Call Common. That sermon was taken from the Acts 10 rooftop encounter between God and Peter, with Peter refusing to eat the unclean animals that God called clean. This confrontation led to the house of Cornelius, where Peter got right what Jonah got wrong. The others do qualify, because in the eyes of God, they are not others at all. And finally, there was To Share God's Heart, a poignant sermon that I delivered to my online audience directly, just me and a camera. We looked at Jonah's message, stacked up against Jonah's attitude. He said what he was supposed to say, but it didn't make him love the Ninevites. I acknowledged that I have the words of God burning in my heart, and a gift to put them together in a way that moves some people. But I painfully confess that I'm not sure I share God's heart for the very audience my words reach. I want to, I long to, and I pray that the positive responses of so many listeners are correct, that I do indeed share God's heart. But their kind words did nothing to assuage the feeling that my words exceed my heart. And so here I am, many sermons and many essays into this wonderful and often painful journey into the story of Jonah, and I've watched two things grow and collide. On one side is the mountainous volume of material that is written about and can be said about this amazing little book. No matter what I uncover, I am still having fun and learning more. And on the other side is the ever-growing and quite uncomfortable truth that I don't really like Jonah at all. See the conflict? I love the book and the story and the characters, the conversations, and the imagery. But I don't like the man. And the uncomfortable part is that my dislike for the man has less to do with him and more to do with me. And the more I settle into this conclusion, the more I realize that maybe that's the point of a good story in the first place. But let's save my discomfort for Jonah. We will close there, though closing is what I wish I could do. Really, we will stop there, as that open-ended discussion never actually ends. First, let's take a brief look at the highlights of some of that mountainous material on this majorly important minor prophet. There are many ways to view the narrative of Jonah. We don't know who wrote it, and we can't prove that he was a real person, though someone of that name does appear in 2 Kings. We have no reason to demand that its account is entirely historically accurate unless we are unfamiliar with the Hebrew tradition of telling folklore and parable. And we shouldn't be unfamiliar with it, since Jesus utilized this style of teaching constantly. But for some reason, we treat the Old Testament stories as if they are the play-by-play box score of a game that actually happened in the past. Shake off the shackles of demanding literalism, and the story comes alive with multiple meaning and layers of possibility. Truthfully, I think we're more comfortable with viewing these stories as history than we are as parable. If they're history, then they are the stories of other people's mistakes and failures. We can nod, smile, and move on. But if they're parables, well, then they're stories of our mistakes and failures, because even though we may not understand parables, we know they exist to tell us stuff we would rather not know. Hebrew parables used a concept of comparison. Consider Jotham's fable of the trees in Judges 9, Nathan's tale of the ewe lamb in 2 Samuel 12, the woman of Tekoa's story of her two sons in 2 Samuel 14, and Isaiah's song of the vineyard in Isaiah 5. These used the Hebrew masal. The Greek equivalent would be the word for parable. The masal focuses on the idea of comparison between something said and something intended. Now, I think this understanding of Hebrew parable qualifies Jonah as a parable. Consider that Nathan's parable of the lamb ends with him showing David that he's the one who has stolen what didn't belong to him, and he cries out, "You are the man." The woman of Tekoa ends her parable with, "In giving this decision, the king convicts himself." And the vineyard song ends with the identity revealed of Israel and Judah. Now, while this Jonah does not end with some big reveal like these parables, I argue that it does indeed end with a very covert reveal. Jonah is the one convicted. But Jonah could also fall into the category of folklore, as it has motifs that appear in folklore of other cultures, some of which predate the story of Jonah. Buddhist literature contains the story of Mittivindaka, who disobeyed his mother and was put out to sea. After 6 days, the ship ceased to move, and the sailors cast lots to determine the one responsible for their trouble, with the lot falling on Mitavendaka 3 times. The sailors put him on a raft and expressed the wish that he not perish, and then the ship continues without difficulty. The Italian tale Pinocchio contains several elements reminiscent with Jonah, including a storm at sea that endangers the boat. When the boat sinks, a shark swallows Geppetto, and the same fate befalls Pinocchio as he seeks to rescue his father. The shark saves them from drowning, and they emerge unharmed. These motifs appear in literature from Egypt and Greece and New Guinea. European tales like Cinderella and Brother Frolic's Adventures show royalty that interacts with peasantry, and the worlds of animals and people freely mingle. There are wonder plants like Jack and the Beanstalk, in which the beanstalk grows up overnight, much like Jonah's shrub. Similar motifs appear in literature from Burma and Hindu and Japan. These aren't perfect examples, of course, just comparisons that might help categorize Jonah. His story has a creator God that stands over everything, intervening when necessary. His story is decidedly prophetic in nature, but unusual even in that, for it's the only one of the prophets that's less about the message delivered and more about the man delivering it. Jonah is even a touch satire. His name means dove, which is an animal known for its gentleness and beauty. And Jonah is the very opposite of those things. It soars while Jonah descends, first into rebellion, then into a boat, and finally into a whale. It also contains elements of mockery, in that whoever wrote it seems to have no problem making fun of the titular character. There are some interesting concepts and categorizations, and if you're like me, you find them fascinating to consider. Everything's on the table, and that makes finding something to eat pretty easy. But then comes the part that I'm not so crazy about, the part that finds me identifying with Jonah a little too closely, which culminates in me not liking him nearly as much as I used to. He just doesn't have a redeeming quality, unless you consider the ability to preach a redeeming quality. And well, I'd like to consider that a redeeming quality because I'm a preacher, and I know a lot of preachers. And I've known some good ones. Better yet, I've known some good men and women who happen to also be preachers. So I'm confident that you can be quality and be good. But I've also known enough good preachers who were pretty deficient in the character and personal quality department. And that makes me think that being a good preacher may not be good enough, because if you knew some of the cats I've known who were good preachers but bad people, you wouldn't hold good preaching in such high regard. Honestly, my dislike for Jonah has nothing to do with his one good quality. I'm sure he was a bold public speaker who knew his stuff, who had a spectacular ability to connect with an audience. He was obviously persuasive, and I probably would have liked that side of him. But all we see is the other stuff, and none of it's good. And too much of it looks a little too familiar. Jonah wants to do what Jonah wants to do. What God calls him to do is another story altogether. I don't like that Jonah's agenda conflicts with his call, and that he sometimes chooses his agenda. Jonah descends into chaos, down into the wrong vessel, going the wrong way, and down further into the belly of hell itself. He fully embraces the chaos he creates. I don't like that Jonah is too familiar with the chaotic. Jonah hides behind his race, presenting it first when he's asked by the mariners who he is. I don't like that Jonah leads with race and knows that it's a topic he can use to explain his situation. Jonah cares more about getting off the boat alive than he does with saving those on the boat. And even when he admits that he's the problem, he doesn't jump overboard. He makes them toss him. I don't like that Jonah can't sacrifice himself at the expense of his neighbor. Jonah is swallowed by the whale and he prays, but he doesn't repent. He doesn't see that he is there because he needs to change. Instead, he makes a few vows to God in order to expedite his release. I don't like that Jonah can't comprehend his own failure and that he trades favors for release from chaos. Jonah preached and Nineveh repented, and Jonah didn't like it because he knew that a good God would forgive, and he wanted his enemies to perish. And I don't like that Jonah doesn't like his audience as much as he likes the sound of his own voice. Jonah got so excited about a little shade bush, probably misinterpreting it as God's favor. And then he grew incredibly angry when that thing which he did nothing to create was destroyed in an instant, and he sulked because things didn't go his way. I don't like that Jonah thinks everything is about him, and he whines when the moment turns on him. Jonah is asked a question that he never answers. Maybe it's because the book ends, or maybe it's because the question is rhetorical. In either case, I don't like that Jonah can't answer the question. Now go back to each of the preceding paragraphs about Jonah, and wherever we wrote, "I don't like that Jonah," insert your own pronoun. "I don't like that I." You may find that you fit into the story better than you want to. I honestly hope you don't fit at all into any of these moments. I hope that when you see Jonah, you shake your head and smile. I hope that you can see him and only him. And then the parable can just be history. The history of a man who ran, and not the story of all of us who run. To each his own. In either case, the story still ends with a question mark. So someone, somewhere, is still asking someone, somewhere. But maybe it's not you. Maybe it's just Jonah. Good luck with that. Grace to you.